Demons, Fyodor Dostoevsky. Chapter 10. Filibusters, A Fatal Morning. The adventure that befell us on the way was also a surprising one, but I must tell the story in due order. An hour before Stepan Trofimovich and I came out into the street, a crowd of people, the hands from Shpigulin's factory, 70 or more in number, had been marching through the town, and had been an object of curiosity to many spectators. They walked intentionally, in good order, and almost in silence. Afterwards, it was asserted that these 70 had been elected out of the whole number of factory hands, amounting to 900, to go to the governor, and to try and get from him, in the absence of their employer, a just settlement of their grievances against the manager, who, in closing the factory and dismissing the workmen, had cheated them all in an impudent way, a fact which has since been proved conclusively. Some people still deny that there was any election of delegates, maintaining that 70 was too large a number to elect, and that the crowd simply consisted of those who had been most unfairly treated, and that they only came to ask for help in their own case, so that the general mutiny of the factory workers, about which there was such an uproar later on, had never existed at all. Others fiercely maintained that these 70 men were not simple strikers but revolutionists, that is, not merely that they were the most turbulent, but that they must have been worked upon by seditious manifestos. The fact is, it is still uncertain whether there had been any outside influence or incitement at work or not. My private opinion is that the workmen had not read the seditious manifestos at all, and if they had read them, would not have understood one word. For one reason, because the authors of such literature write very obscurely in spite of the boldness of their style. But as the workmen really were in a difficult plight, and the police to whom they appealed would not enter into their grievances, what could be more natural than their idea of going in a body to the general himself, if possible, with the petition at their head, forming up in an orderly way before his door, and as soon as he showed himself, all falling on their knees and crying out to him as to Providence itself. To my mind, there is no need to see in this a mutiny, or even a deputation, for it's a traditional, historical mode of action. The Russian people have always loved to parley with the general himself for the mere satisfaction of doing so, regardless of how the conversation may end. And so I am quite convinced that, even though Pyotr Stepanovich, Liputin, and perhaps some others, perhaps even Fedka too, had been flitting about among the workpeople talking to them, and there is fairly good evidence of this, they had only approached 2, 3, 5 at the most, trying to sound them, and nothing had come of their conversation. As for the mutiny they advocated, if the factory workers did understand anything of their propaganda, they would have left off listening to it at once as to something stupid that had nothing to do with them. Fedka was a different matter. He had more success, I believe, than Pyotr Stepanovich. Two workmen are now known for a fact to have assisted Fedka in causing the fire in the town which occurred 3 days afterwards, and a month later, three men who had worked in the factory were arrested for robbery and arson in the province. But if in these cases Fedka did lure them to direct and immediate action, he could only have succeeded with these 5, for we heard of nothing of the sort being done by others. Be that as it may, the whole crowd of workpeople had at last reached the open space in front of the governor's house, and were drawn up there in silence and good order. Then, gaping open-mouthed at the front door, they waited. I am told that as soon as they halted, they took off their caps, that is, a good half-hour before the appearance of the governor, who, as ill luck would have it, was not at home at the moment. The police made their appearance at once. At first, individual policemen, and then as large a contingent of them as could be gathered together. They began, of course, by being menacing, ordering them to break up, but the workmen remained obstinately, like a flock of sheep at a fence, and replied laconically that they had come to see the general himself. It was evident that they were firmly determined. The unnatural shouting of the police ceased, and was quickly succeeded by deliberations, mysterious whispered instructions, and stern, fussy perplexity which wrinkled the brows of the police officers. The head of the police preferred to await the arrival of the governor himself. It was not true that he galloped to the spot with three horses at full speed and began hitting out right and left before he alighted from his carriage. It's true that he used to dash about, and was fond of dashing about at full speed in a carriage with a yellow back, and while his trace horses, who were so trained to carry their heads that they looked positively perverted, galloped more and more frantically. Rousing the enthusiasm of all the shopkeepers in the bazaar, he would rise up in the carriage, stand erect, holding on by a strap which had been fixed on purpose at the side, and, with his right arm extended into space like a figure on a monument, survey the town majestically. But in the present case he did not use his fists, and though, as he got out of the carriage, he could not refrain from a forcible expression, this was simply done to keep up his popularity. There is a still more absurd story that soldiers were brought up with bayonets, and that a telegram was sent for artillery and Cossacks. Those are legends which are not believed now, even by those who invented them. It's an absurd story, too, that barrels of water were brought from the fire brigade, and that people were drenched with water from them. The simple fact is that Ilya Ilyich shouted in his heat that he wouldn't let one of them come dry out of the water. Probably this was the foundation of the barrel legend which got into the columns of the Petersburg and Moscow newspapers. Probably the most accurate version was that at first all the available police formed a cordon round the crowd, and a messenger was sent for Lempke, a police superintendent, who dashed off in the carriage belonging to the head of the police on the way to Skvoreshniki, knowing that Lempke had gone there in his carriage half an hour before. But I must confess that I am still unable to answer the question how they could, at first sight, from the first moment, have transformed an insignificant, that is to say, an ordinary crowd of petitioners, even though there were several of them, into a rebellion which threatened to shake the foundations of the state. Why did Lempke himself rush at that idea when he arrived 20 minutes after the messenger? I imagine, but again it's only my private opinion, that it was to the interest of Ilya Ilyich, who was a crony of the factory managers, to represent the crowd in this light to Lempke, in order to prevent him from going into the case. And Lempke himself had put the idea into his head. In the course of the last 2 days, he had had two unusual and mysterious conversations with him. It is true, they were exceedingly obscure, but Ilya Ilyich was able to gather from them that the governor had thoroughly made up his mind that there were political manifestos, and that Spigulin's factory hands were being incited to a socialist rising, and that he was so persuaded of it that he would perhaps have regretted it if the story had turned out to be nonsense. "He wants to get distinction in Petersburg," our wily Ilya Ilyich thought to himself as he left von Lempke. "Well, that just suits me." But I am convinced that poor Andrei Antonovitch would not have desired a rebellion even for the sake of distinguishing himself. He was a most conscientious official, who had lived in a state of innocence up to the time of his marriage. And was it his fault that, instead of an innocent allowance of wood from the government, and an equally innocent Minchen, a princess of 40 summers had raised him to her level? I know almost for certain that the unmistakable symptoms of the mental condition which brought poor Andrei Antonovitch to a well-known establishment in Switzerland, where, I am told, he is now regaining his energies, were first apparent on that fatal morning. But once we admit that unmistakable signs of something were visible that morning, it may well be allowed that similar symptoms may have been evident the day before, though not so clearly. I happen to know from the most private sources. Well, you may assume that Yulia Mikhailovna later on, not in triumph but almost in remorse, for a woman who is incapable of complete remorse, revealed part of it to me herself. That Andrei Antonovitch had gone into his wife's room in the middle of the previous night, past 2 o'clock in the morning, had waked her up, and had insisted on her listening to his ultimatum. He demanded it so insistently that she was obliged to get up from her bed in indignation and curl papers, and sitting down on a couch she had to listen, though with sarcastic disdain. Only then she grasped for the first time how far gone her Andrei Antonovitch was, and was secretly horrified. She ought to have thought what she was about and have been softened, but she concealed her horror, and was more obstinate than ever. Like every wife, she had her own method of treating Andrei Antonovitch, which she had tried more than once already, and with it driven him to frenzy. Yulia Mikhailovna's method was that of contemptuous silence, for 1 hour, two, a whole day, and almost for 3 days and nights. Silence, whatever happened, whatever he said, whatever he did, even if he had clambered up to throw himself out of a three-story window, a method unendurable for a sensitive man. Whether Yulia Mikhailovna meant to punish her husband for his blunders of the last few days and the jealous envy he, as the chief authority in the town, felt for her administrative abilities, whether she was indignant at his criticism of her behaviour with the young people and local society generally, and lack of comprehension of her subtle and far-sighted political aims, or was angry with his stupid and senseless jealousy of Pyotr Stepanovitch, however that may have been, she made up her mind not to be softened even now, in spite of its being 3 o'clock at night, and though Andrei Antonovitch was in a state of emotion such as she had never seen him in before. Pacing up and down in all directions over the rugs of her boudoir beside himself, he poured out everything, everything, quite disconnectedly, it's true, but everything that had been rankling in his heart for— "It was outrageous," he began, by saying that he was a laughing-stock to everyone, and was being led by the nose. "Curse the expression," he squealed, at once catching her smile. "Let it stand. It's true." "No, madam, the time has come. Let me tell you, it's not a time for laughter and feminine arts now. We are not in the boudoir of a mincing lady, but like two abstract creatures in a balloon who have met to speak the truth." He was no doubt confused and could not find the right words for his ideas, however just they were. "It is you, madam, you who have destroyed my happy past. I took up this post simply for your sake, for the sake of your ambition. You smile sarcastically. Don't triumph, don't be in a hurry. Let me tell you, madam, let me tell you that I should have been equal to this position, and not only this position, but a dozen positions like it, for I have abilities. But with you, madam, with you, it's impossible. For with you here, I have no abilities. There cannot be two centres, and you have created two, one of mine and one in your boudoir. Two centres of power, madam. But I won't allow it. I won't allow it. In the service, as in marriage, there must be one centre. Two are impossible. How have you repaid me?" he went on. "Our marriage has been nothing but you proving to me all the time, every hour, that I am a nonentity, a fool, and even a rascal. And I have been all the time, every hour, forced in a degrading way to prove to you that I am not a nonentity, not a fool at all, and that I impress everyone with my honourable character. Isn't that degrading for both sides?" At this point, he began rapidly stamping with both feet on the carpet, so that Yulia Mikhailovna was obliged to get up with stern dignity. He subsided quickly, but passed to being pathetic, and began sobbing. Yes, sobbing, beating himself on the breast almost for 5 minutes, getting more and more frantic at Yulia Mikhailovna's profound silence. At last he made a fatal blunder, and let slip that he was jealous of Pyotr Stepanovich. Realizing that he had made an utter fool of himself, he became savagely furious and shouted that he would not allow them to deny God, and that he would send her salon of irresponsible infidels packing, that the governor of a province was bound to believe in God, and so his wife was too, that he wouldn't put up with these young men, that you, madam, for the sake of your own dignity, ought to have thought of your husband, and to have stood up for his intelligence, even if he were a man of poor abilities, and I'm by no means a man of poor abilities. And yet it's your doing that everyone here despises me. It was you put them all up to it. He shouted that he would annihilate the woman question, that he would eradicate every trace of it, that tomorrow he would forbid and break up their silly fate for the benefit of the governesses, damn them. That the first governess he came across tomorrow morning he would drive out of the province. "With a Cossack! I'll make a point of it!" he shrieked. "Do you know," he screamed, "do you know that your rascals are inciting men at the factory, and that I know of it? Let me tell you, I know the names of four of these rascals, and that I am going out of my mind, hopelessly, hopelessly." But at this point, Yulia Mikhailovna suddenly broke her silence, and suddenly announced that she had long been aware of these criminal designs, and that it was all foolishness, and that he had taken it too seriously, and that as for these mischievous fellows, she knew not only those four, but all of them. It was a lie. But that she had not the faintest intention of going out of her mind on account of it, but, on the contrary, had all the more confidence in her intelligence and hoped to bring it all to a harmonious conclusion, to encourage the young people, to bring them to reason, to show them suddenly and unexpectedly that their designs were known, and then to point out to them new aims for rational and more noble activity. Oh, how can I describe the effect of this on Andrei Antonovitch? Hearing that Pyotr Stepanovitch had duped him again and had made a fool of him so coarsely, that he had told her much more than he had told him, and sooner than him, and that perhaps Pyotr Stepanovitch was the chief instigator of all these criminal designs, he flew into a frenzy. "Senseless but malignant woman!" he cried, snapping his bonds at one blow. "Let me tell you, I shall arrest your worthless lover at once. I shall put him in fetters and send him to the fortress, or I shall jump out of the window before your eyes this minute." Yulia Mikhailovna, turning green with anger, greeted this tirade at once with a burst of prolonged, ringing laughter, going off into peals such as one hears at the French theatre when a Parisian actress, imported for a fee of 100,000 to play a coquette, laughs in her husband's face for daring to be jealous of her. Von Lempke rushed to the window, but suddenly stopped as though rooted to the spot, folded his arms across his chest, and, white as a corpse, looked with a sinister gaze at the laughing lady. "Do you know, Yulia? Do you know?" he said, in a gasping and suppliant voice. "Do you know that even I can do something?" But at the renewed and even louder laughter that followed his last words, he clenched his teeth, groaned, and suddenly rushed, not towards the window, but at his spouse, with his fist raised. He did not bring it down. No, I repeat again and again, no. But it was the last straw. He ran to his own room, not knowing what he was doing, flung himself, dressed as he was, face downwards on his bed, wrapped himself convulsively, head and all, in the sheet, and lay so for 2 hours, incapable of sleep, incapable of thought, with a load on his heart and blank, immovable despair in his soul. Now and then he shivered all over with an agonizing, feverish tremor. Disconnected and irrelevant things kept coming into his mind. At one minute he thought of the old clock which used to hang on his wall 15 years ago in Petersburg and had lost the minute hand. at another of the cheerful clerk, Millebois, and how they had once caught a sparrow together in Alexandrovsky Park, and had laughed so that they could be heard all over the park, remembering that one of them was already a college assessor. I imagine that about 7 in the morning he must have fallen asleep without being aware of it himself, and must have slept with enjoyment, with agreeable dreams. Waking about 10 o'clock, he jumped wildly out of bed, remembered everything at once, and slapped himself on the head. He refused his breakfast, and would see neither Bloom nor the chief of the police, nor the clerk, who came to remind him that he was expected to preside over a meeting that morning. He would listen to nothing, and did not want to understand. He ran like one possessed to Yulia Mikhailovna's part of the house. There, Sofya Antropovna, an old lady of good family who had lived for years with Yulia Mikhailovna, explained to him that his wife had set off at 10 o'clock that morning with a large company in 3 carriages to Varvara Petrovna Stavrogin's, to Skvoreshniki, to look over the place with a view to the second fete which was planned for a fortnight later, and that the visit today had been arranged with Varvara Petrovna 3 days before. Overwhelmed with this news, Andrei Antonovitch returned to his study and impulsively ordered the horses. He could hardly wait for them to be got ready. His soul was hungering for Yulia Mikhailovna, to look at her, to be near her for 5 minutes. Perhaps she would glance at him, notice him, would smile as before, forgive him. "Oh, aren't the horses ready?" Mechanically, he opened a thick book lying on the table. He sometimes used to try his fortune in this way with a book, opening it at random and reading the 3 lines at the top of the right-hand page. What turned up was, "Tout est pour le mieux dans le meilleur des mondes possible." Voltaire, Candide. He uttered an ejaculation of contempt and ran to get into the carriage. Skvoreshniki! The coachman said afterwards that his master urged him on all the way, but as soon as they were getting near the mansion, he suddenly told him to turn and drive back to the town, bidding him, "Drive fast, please, drive fast." Before they reached the town wall, "Master told me to stop again, got out of the carriage, and went across the road into the field. I thought he felt ill, but he stopped and began looking at the flowers, and so he stood for a time. It was strange, really. I began to feel quite uneasy." This was the coachman's testimony. I remember the weather that morning. It was a cold, clear but windy September day, before Andrei Antonovitch stretched a forbidding landscape of bare fields from which the crop had long been harvested. There were a few dying yellow flowers, pitiful relics blown about by the howling wind. Did he want to compare himself and his fate with those wretched flowers battered by the autumn and the frost? I don't think so. In fact, I feel sure it was not so, and that he realized nothing about the flowers, in spite of the evidence of the coachman and of the police superintendent, who drove up that moment and asserted afterwards that he found the governor with a bunch of yellow flowers in his hand. This police superintendent, Flibusterov by name, was an ardent champion of authority who had only recently come to our town, but had already distinguished himself and become famous by his inordinate zeal, by a certain vehemence in the execution of his duties, and his inveterate inebriety. Jumping out of the carriage, and not the least disconcerted at the sight of what the governor was doing, he blurted out all in one breath, with a frantic expression, yet with an air of conviction, that, "There's an upset in the town." "Eh? What?" said Andrei Antonovitch, turning to him with a stern face, but without a trace of surprise, or any recollection of his carriage and his coachman, as though he had been in his own study. "Police Superintendent Flibusterov, Your Excellency. There's a riot in the town." "Filibusters," Andrei Antonovitch said thoughtfully. "Just so, Your Excellency. The Shpigulin men are making a riot."
The Spigulin men.
The name Spigulin seemed to remind him of something. He started and put his finger to his forehead.
The Spigulin men.
In silence, and still plunged in thought, he walked without haste to the carriage, took his seat, and told the coachman to drive to the town. The police superintendent followed in the droshky. I imagine that he had vague impressions of many interesting things of all sorts on the way, but I doubt whether he had any definite idea or any settled intention as he drove into the open space in front of his house. But no sooner did he see the resolute and orderly ranks of the rioters, the cordon of police, the helpless and perhaps purposely helpless chief of police, and the general expectation of which he was the object, then all the blood rushed to his heart. With a pale face, he stepped out of his carriage.
"Caps off!" he said breathlessly and hardly audibly. "On your knees!"
he squealed, to the surprise of everyone, to his own surprise too, and perhaps the very unexpectedness of the position was the explanation of what followed. Can a sledge on a switchback at carnival stop short as it flies down the hill? What made it worse, Andrei Antonovitch had been all his life serene in character, and never shouted or stamped at anyone, and such people are always the most dangerous if it once happens that something sets their sledge sliding downhill. Everything was whirling before his eyes.
"Filibusters!"
he yelled, still more shrilly and absurdly, and his voice broke. He stood, not knowing what he was going to do, but knowing and feeling in his whole being that he certainly would do something directly.
"Lord!"
was heard from the crowd. A lad began crossing himself. Three or four men actually did try to kneel down, but the whole mass moved three steps forward, and suddenly all began talking at once.
"Your Excellency, we were hired for a term. The manager, you mustn't say—"
and so on and so on. It was impossible to distinguish anything. Alas, Andrei Antonovitch could distinguish nothing. The flowers were still in his hands. The riot was as real to him as the prison carts were to Stepan Trofimovitch, and flitting to and fro in the crowd of rioters who gazed open-eyed at him, he seemed to see Pyotr Stepanovitch, who had egged them on, Pyotr Stepanovitch, whom he hated and whose image had never left him since yesterday.
"Rods!"
he cried, even more unexpectedly. A dead silence followed. From the facts I have learnt and those I have conjectured, this must have been what happened at the beginning, but I have no such exact information for what followed, nor can I conjecture it so easily. There are some facts, however. In the first place, rods were brought on the scene with strange rapidity. They had evidently been got ready beforehand in expectation by the intelligent chief of the police. Not more than two, or at most three, were actually flogged, however. That fact I wish to lay stress on. It's an absolute fabrication to say that the whole crowd of rioters, or at least half of them, were punished. It is a nonsensical story, too, that a poor but respectable lady was caught as she passed by and promptly thrashed. Yet I read myself an account of this incident afterwards among the provincial items of a Petersburg newspaper. Many people in the town talked of an old woman called Avdotya Petrovna Tarapigin, who lived in the almshouse by the cemetery. She was said, on her way home from visiting a friend, to have forced her way into the crowd of spectators through natural curiosity. Seeing what was going on, she cried out, "What a shame!" and spat on the ground. For this, it was said, she had been seized and flogged too. This story not only appeared in print, but in our excitement we positively got up a subscription for her benefit. I subscribed 20 kopecks myself. And would you believe it? It appears now that there was no old woman called Tarapigin living in the almshouse at all. I went to inquire at the almshouse by the cemetery myself. They had never heard of anyone called Tarapigin there. And, what's more,
They were quite offended when I told them the story that was going round. I mention this fabulous Avdotya Petrovna because what happened to her, if she really had existed, very nearly happened to Stepan Trofimovitch. Possibly, indeed, his adventure may have been at the bottom of the ridiculous tale about the old woman. That is, as the gossip went on growing, he was transformed into this old dame. What I find most difficult to understand is how he came to slip away from me as soon as he got into the square. As I had a misgiving of something very unpleasant, I wanted to take him round the square straight to the entrance to the governor's, but my own curiosity was roused, and I stopped only for 1 minute to question the first person I came across, and suddenly I looked round and found Stepan Trofimovitch no longer at my side. Instinctively, I darted off to look for him in the most dangerous place. Something made me feel that his sledge, too, was flying downhill. And I did, as a fact, find him in the very centre of things. I remember I seized him by the arm, but he looked quietly and proudly at me, with an air of immense authority. "Cher," he pronounced in a voice which quivered on a breaking note. "If they are dealing with people so unceremoniously before us, in an open square, what is to be expected from that man, for instance, if he happens to act on his own authority?" And, shaking with indignation and with an intense desire to defy them, he pointed a menacing, accusing finger at Flibusterov, who was gazing at us, open-eyed, 2 paces away. "That man!" cried the latter, blind with rage. "What man, and who are you?" He stepped up to him, clenching his fist. "Who are you?" he roared, ferociously, hysterically, and desperately. I must mention that he knew Stepan Trofimovitch perfectly well by sight. Another moment, and he would have certainly seized him by the collar, but luckily, hearing him shout, Lempke turned his head. He gazed intensely but with perplexity at Stepan Trofimovitch, seeming to consider something, and suddenly he shook his head impatiently. Flibusterov was checked. I drew Stepan Trofimovitch out of the crowd, though perhaps he may have wished to retreat himself. "Home! Home!" I insisted. "It was certainly thanks to Lempke that we were not beaten." "Go, my friend. I am to blame for exposing you to this. You have a future and a career of a sort before you, while I... mon heure est sonnée." He resolutely mounted the governor's steps. The hall porter knew me. I said that we both wanted to see Yulia Mihailovna. We sat down in the waiting room and waited. I was unwilling to leave my friend, but I thought it unnecessary to say anything more to him. He had the air of a man who had consecrated himself to certain death for the sake of his country. We sat down, not side by side, but in different corners, I nearer to the entrance, he at some distance, facing me, with his head bent in thought, leaning lightly on his stick. He held his wide-brimmed hat in his left hand. We sat like that for 10 minutes.